Acupuncture in Portland. Dr. Mutulu Shakur was one of the founders of the Black Acupuncture Advisory Association in North America and the Harlem Institute of Acupuncture. Incarcerated for 30 years, Mutulu and his legal team are seeking community and financial support to fight his imprisonment. A group of licensed acupuncturists and massage therapists are offering treatments to our community as a fundraiser. Again, that's of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture, 436 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Hello and welcome to the film show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and I'll be joined in just a few minutes by my co-host Jen Chavez. Jen will be talking this morning with Kelly Kend, director of the new documentary, Yeah, Maybe, No. It's a film about sexual consent and coercion. And I'll be joined in the studio by local filmmakers whose work is featured in the upcoming Portland International Film Festival. Don Jones Redstone and Howard Mitchell are here, and so is Ben Pop from the Northwest Film Center. But first, we're joined by Ian Sundahl. Ian is the curator of Repressed Cinema, a monthly film series that screens at the Hollywood Theater. Ian, welcome to the film show.
Oh, hi, thank you. Yeah, it's nice to be here.
Yeah, so you have a monthly show at the Hollywood Theater, and it's usually actual film, not so much video, some video, but it's the third Tuesday of the month, and this coming month it's going to be on the February 16th. And tell us about Repressed Cinema.
Oh, well, for just over 3 years, every month we've been playing oddball stuff that's, kind of off the wall, you know, oddball stuff, exploitation, anything that we've come across, and it's been a lot of fun. It's kind of like a party out. We always try and sell comics in the lobby and get some old trailers and before the show, and it is always film. Sometimes there'll be some video, but yeah, it's a good time.
And this month, you've got this is probably an 18 and over a screening this month. It's Invasion of the B-Girls from the 1970s. It looks pretty spicy.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting film. It's all about some B-Girls that take over a California town. It's from 1973. It's got Cliff Osmond, who plays a cop. You might remember him from Sweet Sugar.
So this is almost like a sci-fi exploitation film. It's like these girls get turned into bees, or there's a queen bee in there somewhere. Sometimes with these stories, it's kind of hard to tell what exactly is the motivating factor.
Yeah, this one's definitely got a tongue-in-cheek feel to it. Yeah, it's, you know, they kind of take over the town and start killing off the guys. Plenty of nudity. You know, it's just a real oddball film. A real good drive-in movie.
And heckling is not discouraged, I don't think.
So. Oh, actually, well, not really heckle vision here Repressed.
Not so much,
heckle
vision. Okay, yeah. So it's laugh along, but don't interrupt it so much.
Right, there you go.
And you've got some trailers that go along with this and maybe some other short features that will accompany the Repressed Cinema theme.
Yeah, we try and make it like a real old show, you know, have some theater tags, you know, no smoking in the lobby, vintage trailers from the same time period. So it's like a real, you know, brings you back in time.
And along with the analog film aspect, you also have analog print. You've got comics and other mini publications out available on tables out in the lobby.
Yep, correct. There'll be underground comics for sale in the lobby, and free. There's going to be a free comic, a Vision Quest, that's having a new issue. So,
yeah, you just had a big opening party at Floating World to break out that comic.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
So, so this is again. This is happening the third Tuesday usually of the month. So this is Tuesday, February 16th at the Hollywood Theater. And people can go to the Hollywood it's Hollywood Theater with an RE.org to get more information.
Yeah, they'll be up on the website in the next couple days. And Tuesday, February 16th at 7:30.
And can people sign up to get alerts about your upcoming screenings?
Yeah, I do have an email list. So go ahead and write your name down in the lobby.
Okay, fantastic. So again, February 16th, Tuesday evening at the Hollywood Theater. It's Repressed Cinema. Ian Sundahl, thank you so much for joining us here on The Film Show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're tuned into The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser. And in a few minutes, I'll be joined in the studio by filmmakers Dawn Jones-Redstone and Howard Mitchell, whose short films are featured in next month's Portland International Film Festival. Right now, though, I am joined by my co-host, Jen Chavez. And Jen's going to be talking with Kelly Kend. She's the director of the new documentary, Yeah, Maybe, No. So with no further ado, here's Jen.
A new Portland considers the meaning of consent through a story of survival. I'd like to quickly issue a trigger warning here before we begin, as the following interview contains discussion of sexual assault. Local documentarian Kelly Kend's latest film, Yeah, Maybe, No, lives in and analyzes the gray area of what it means to consent to sexual activity. What was set out to be a film about rape, looking at survivors' stories through the lens of the filmmaker's own survival, morphed into a complex analysis of what constitutes consent and what constitutes sexual assault, challenging multiple stereotypes and preconceived notions about who sexual assault survivors and perpetrators are. The film coincides with a nationwide movement to support sexual assault victims and reduce endemic levels of sexual violence on college campuses across the country. Kelly joins me now in studio to discuss her film. Kelly, thank you very much for joining me and welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Hello. So your documentary, Yeah, Maybe, No, your subject is a young gay man, Blake, who told you about his experiences while a student at your alma mater, Reed College in Portland. He does not fit into the stereotypical mold of what a sexual assault victim is in a conversation that typically centers around young heterosexual women. And I think he really provides a lot of insight into who sexual predators are and can be too, whether they're an acquaintance at a party or your intimate partner. Why did you choose to amplify Blake's story? What unique things can we learn from it?
Well, it's interesting that you're saying the conversation normally revolves around heterosexual women. So when I was talking to a man about these stories, a lot of what he was saying sounded really familiar to me. Mm-hmm. And I'd been having conversations with people about predators, and they would go into this place that was about like, well, women are stereotypically weak and men are strong. So there's this evolutionary biology says that you're all going to get raped or like whatever, like that internet right. hyperbole, like sometimes ends up there. And so I felt that by talking to a man, you just avoided all of that. And you were able to, or I felt like I was really able to look at like dynamics around predators and around targeting in a way that didn't engage with preconceived notions about women.
One interesting thing about the timing of Blake's experiences is that as his college experience at Reed progressed, what he refers to as a consent revolution was happening there. Student activists put enough pressure on administrators that an assistant dean was hired to handle sexual assault prevention. And this woman, Jill Schaefer, helped the school step up support for survivors and do campus-wide outreach about consent. Can you talk about how this type of activism and how this type of sharing of stories that's happening on campuses across the country empowers people who survive sexual assault?
Well, I mean, it's sort of like what Blake says, that before he encountered all these people talking about consent, to him it was just this thing that happened that sucked and that left him feeling really vulnerable and upset. But then, you know, when he listened to people say, like, no, experiences that leave you feeling this way, that, like, that happen in this way, that's sexual assault, that's rape, he was like, oh, like, you know, it was this sort of retroactive realizing. And I've heard that from a lot of people, not just Blake.
I'm wondering what the challenges are of making a film about something you have been through. And I know that that's a huge question. What I mean is, you have had this long process of years of considering the meaning of your own consent and coming to terms with survival. Honestly, I also had experiences as a young woman that left me asking some of the same kinds of questions that you consider in your film. And I can completely relate to having this evolving and confusing thought process over years at a time and thinking you have it figured out when you don't. And here you're making a documentary about a subject and their story ends up challenging your understanding of sexual assault. And I think it was really great that you spoke honestly in the film about how it did so. But I'm wondering how that was difficult to navigate as a filmmaker.
Yeah, that was really hard. 'Cause, like, at the center of the film is kind of this misunderstanding that I had with Blake, where I was waiting for, like, a bombshell of a story, and then, like, he didn't actually have one. And he had a really, like, quiet, mundane story, but it hurt him as badly as you would expect, like, a bombshell story to hurt him. And that's what I realized was the most interesting thing that had happened. And it's a hard thing to make a film about because, you know, it's not a straightforward sort of rising and falling action sort of plot, but that's what we did.
You know, something else, actually, one of, I think, the most illuminating aspects of the film for me is looking at peer support and how some people can either be knowingly insensitive or inadvertently at least reinforce a survivor's self-blame, which is another big theme of the film. Even other survivors, as the woman you spoke to at Reed so rightly points out, in my opinion, that it, for a lot of people, hits close to home. What would you say is the best way to support a peer who comes to you and opens up about a sexual assault?
I mean, it's hard because a lot of people really do want to be supportive and they really don't know what to say. And so a lot of people, I think, feel angry for that person or they feel uncomfortable for themselves and they can sometimes get defensive or they really want to, like, blame somebody and be like, oh, well, who did it? I'm going to go get that person and I'm going to go do whatever to that person. And I think that, like, people need to not do that and that the focus should stay on the person telling the story and asking them, like, are you okay? What do you need? You know, listening if that's what they want or not pushing them to tell more details. You know, a lot of people are like, well, what really happened? Tell me all the details. And people don't always want to tell you all of these, like, really private, intimate details.
Yeah.
And I think you have to, so if you want to support somebody, you really have to kind of honor where the survivor is. And I think the first step is to, like, separate out supporting somebody who's, like, your friend and loved one and separating that from, like, going after the perpetrator, because the person telling you something happened may or may not want to go after the perpetrator. And
exactly.
If they don't want to, you have to respect that. And that is so hard to do.
One last thing that your film touches on. At the end of your film, you spend some time talking about yes means yes laws or affirmative consent laws that are being pushed for in California and New York, I also read. Could you tell us what these laws would do and how do you think policy changes like this can impact the level of, say, sexual assault on campuses?
So Yes Means Yes is a law designed to make enthusiastic consent the standard. And it's controversial because if you're accused, it becomes your job to prove that you had a yes. But right now, like, if you are sexually assaulted and you accuse somebody, it's your job to prove that you fought back, that you said no, that, you know, you kicked them hard enough or whatever. And this law would be like, if you accuse somebody, it's their job to say, well, I know I had consent because whatever. So it's a way of saying like silence is not consent because a lot of people freeze up, you know.
Right. Or even say yes, but just like can't move.
Yeah. I think in order to make a law work for those people, that's what I see the yes means yes law is doing.
Before I let you go, I'd love to hear if there are any bits of news on how people can see this film.
Right now, I'm really interested in booking educational screenings. So I'm working with schools and community groups. If you go to my website, you can sign up to host a screening. And any school or community group who wants to host a screening can.
I've been speaking today with Kelly Kent, the documentarian behind the new film, Yeah, Maybe No, a documentary on consent. Kelly, thank you so very much for joining me in the studio today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jen. Jen Chavez was talking with Kelly Kent, director of the new documentary, Yeah, Maybe No. And we just had a little bit of Mingus there, and I'll explain that in just a minute. I'm SW Conser, and you're listening to The Film Show. Right now, we have Ben Pop in the studio. Ben, welcome back to KBOO. Yes. Last time you joined us, you were in charge of the Experimental Film Festival, along with Hannah Piper Burns. Now you've gone all mainstream, relatively speaking. What happened there?
Well, you know, things change, life changes. So, moved on. Yeah. So now I'm the Filmmaker Services Manager at the Northwest Film Center.
And you've brought some filmmakers with you today. These are directors of short films, which will be playing at PIFF's Oregon Short Screening. When is that coming up?
That's going to be, so PIFF is going to be starting February 11th through the 27th, and the Oregon Shorts program is going to be February 20th at 1 p.m. at the Witzel Auditorium, and then February 22nd at the Roseway Theater at 6 p.m.
So let's talk to a couple of the filmmakers that you brought with you. Don Jones-Redstone and Howard Mitchell, welcome to the film show.
Thanks for having us.
So, Don, your film is Sista in the Brotherhood.
Yes.
And I have to confess, I watched the screener to your film at home with my girlfriend. She was right there shouting at the screen the whole time.
That's what we want. People shouting at screens.
It roused some passion. I'm going to say that this is a film that has a little bit of magical realism. No spoilers, but it seems like it's taken from real incidents. Like you really researched some incidents there.
Yes. Well, in addition to the fact that I was a union carpenter, I worked in the trades for 6 years and then taught women to go to work in the construction trades at a nonprofit called Oregon Tradeswomen. I did that for 9 years. The work is also inspired by the doctoral thesis of Roberta Hunt, who wrote about the Black tradeswoman experience.
So you, this is a fully a work that you adapted and wrote yourself.
Yeah, Howard. I co-wrote it with Sherson Johnson. So it's an original work. It's not based on her thesis, but it's definitely many of the themes of her work are apparent in the film.
Now, one thing I noticed is there's not a lot of films, American films these days, that are about working people, about tradespeople. You know, Ken Loach did some really great stuff, Paul Schrader. And so, you know, there's something that you said right before we went on, that there's really only one American feature of recent vintage that's about women in the trades.
Yeah, and tradeswomen in particular, and that is Flashdance. And my response to that is, we can do better.
What a feeling.
Even though, you know, on a visceral level, like I loved that film when I was younger, and I'm sure I was inspired by it in a way, but this is not that film.
Well, let's talk for a minute to Howard Mitchell.
Hey.
Howard, your film is part of the TriMet trilogy.
Yes.
So you are working around a theme of the transit.
Yes.
Here but it's not like about the transit.
No.
So much. It's definitely about people. And this one is called Le Tram.
Yes, Le Tram, a French word for the tram. But yeah, it's really not about the tram or the bus or anything like that. It's about how people kind of connect around the transit system. We sit with each other all the time, but do we really communicate? And do we really try to figure out what's going on with each other's lives? And when we do communicate, are we really connecting? I don't know. I'm interested in this idea of buses and trains and all these other types of modes of transportation. We're getting to and fro places in the hustle and bustle, but where's our humanity in the middle of all that kind of thing? So I'm just kind of interested in that kind of thing, since I take the bus a lot, actually.
Well, there's a, you know, it's interesting to sort of kind of let yourself ease into this film because you have a lot of different voices. Some of them are coming over the radio. Yeah. There's a lot of sound. It's ambient sound. It's like you're a David Lynch fan there. I can get a sense of that. And you were going for something with some of the colors you were working with, some of the sounds you were working with, all of this stuff. It's narrative in one sense, but it's in another sense like going into like a deeper sense of what early filmmakers were going for.
Well, absolutely going for that. I mean, this idea of the sound being the second sight, that sound kind of implies and infers something else that's going on. It's not just you're watching it. I want you to feel it. And I think sound can really do that as well as color. And I'm like I was talking earlier about this idea about synesthesia. Synesthesia is something that can affect even how what you're tasting. So, I mean, you can't get more experimental than that. If you're watching a film of mine and you can taste something, then I've done my job, you know.
Well, sometimes you can get the sense, like if you're showing, if you're just showing the surroundings, you know, you can get a sense of the air. You can get a sense of what might be blowing past, you know, in the distance and all like that.
Yeah. Atmosphere, man. I want people to feel it and get a sense of what's going on around them. Feel it. Taste it. You know. Color itself kind of can resonate in a way that maybe visually what's going on in the story can't. So color can kind of create a mood. So, yeah, man, I'm just trying to experiment and push the medium a little bit.
Well, Don and Howard, you both have I'm going to step out of my journalist role a little bit and say if anybody comes here looking for some, you know, kind of amateur student in quotes, I will say, because I know, Howard, that you're a student, and this could literally be a student film if you want to. But this, you've both got crews that have incredible experience here in town. These are great cinematographers, great post-production people, great sound people. And so people who come to look at these shorts are going to say, you know, Hollywood's got nothing on Portland here. You've really got some great people you've been working with.
Yeah, we're very fortunate with both cast and crew. I think people were attracted to the subject matter, something that was unique, and we were also able to round up some significant donations because we did a Kickstarter campaign, we did a rec grant, but Kerner Camera, Pro Photo Supply, Rex Post all made significant donations. It really improved the quality of the film.
It sounds like maybe social media and the accessibility of digital technology now is helping you both. You know, it's easier to color time something, make it color correct, make stuff look really solid.
Yeah, I mean, color timing for me, it was a learning process as I went along. I mean, I just have a specific aesthetic that I'm going for, and I know what I want. So I actually jumped in myself, kind of learned it, which was a big learning curve. And I don't know. I mean, this I'm attracted to color, and with the access to digital equipment now, you can kind of learn it yourself, man. YouTube it and just do it.
And we noted we were talking about cable access and Portland community media. There's a lot of workshops people can take for not very much money nowadays.
Yep, true.
So tell us a little bit about more about what you're looking forward to. Howard, I know that you said you were working on a feature film now.
I am working on a noir, a Portland noir, yes, where the mayor is implicated in a crime.
Okay.
Putting fluoride into the water. And to cover up some insidious behavior that he's been doing.
And Dawn, what's next for you?
We are talking about the feature version of this 20-minute short film.
So, really?
You may be able to potentially use the short as a calling card to show what we can do.
Well, that is definitely one way to... Are you... you're at PIFF. You're at the Portland International Film Festival, both of you. Are you... Is this the first place that you're rolling out these shorts? And if so, are you moving on to other festivals? Are you applying to other festivals?
We are... we actually had our own little premiere for our Kickstarter supporters and with Oregon Tradeswomen that sold out Clinton Street Theater. And then our festival premiere will be at PIFF. We're also going to be screening... opening night, kicking off... another festival. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say it yet. It hasn't been announced, but another local festival. And we'll also be screening at PSU, and we've submitted to festivals around the country. So we're waiting to see.
Mine's being shown worldwide, man. As we speak, hopefully, I sent it everywhere. But it's at the New York Film Festival, I believe. It got accepted recently. And just keep pushing it out there. If you know of some other ones I can submit it to, let me know.
Well, people can find out more about Dawn's film. It's Sista in the Brotherhood, S-I-S-T-A in the Brotherhood, www.pfilmshow.com. And Howard, how do people find out about your film?
You can, if you find me on the street, just say, hey, man, tell me more about your film. I'll tell you. But you can find me on my website at, let's see, The Black Cat with two T's. That's TheBlackCat.com.
All right. And Ben Pop.
Yeah.
Okay, tell us once again how people can find out more about the Oregon Shorts program and at the Portland International Film Festival in general.
Yeah, by all means. Tickets are on sale now. All the details can be found at nwfilm.org. It's going to be a fantastic festival with screenings all over the city, and super, super excited about this Oregon Shorts program. It's going to be fantastic.
And if people want to meet some of these filmmakers, they can come to a reception. It's going to be Saturday the 20th after the screening.
After the screening. Come to the screening. It's at 1 p.m. and come to the reception. It's going to be at the Film Center, and meet these guys, talk to them, give them love.
I need it.
All right. Well, Don Jones Redstone, Howard Mitchell, and Ben Pop from the Portland International Film Festival, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
And now here's Jen with the film calendar.
Here's a list of some film events coming up in the next month. Tonight through February 5th, the Real Music Festival continues at the Northwest Film Center. Real Music is on its 33rd year of celebrating the crossovers of sound, music, and image, this year showcasing an eclectic mix of music, docs, and performance films from the genres of jazz, blues, rock, soul, opera, classical, avant-garde, and more. 9 screenings still remain, and the last blues and roots music documentary, American Epic, on February 5th at 7 p.m., is sponsored by KBOO. More info about remaining films and showtimes at nwfilm.org. Opening tomorrow, January 29th, the Hollywood Theater will be partaking in its annual screenings of Oscar-nominated short films as Oscar night approaches in February. They're presented in 2 programs, live action and animated, with showtimes through early February. Details can be found at hollywoodtheater.org. Running February 5th through March 5th, the Cascade Festival of African Films celebrates African films and filmmakers in honor of Black History Month. The majority of the 26th annual festival will take place on the PCC Cascade campus with over a dozen films on the roster, but opening night will showcase the film The Rooftops at the Hollywood Theater at 6 and 9:15 with director Merzak Alawash in attendance. More information is available at africanfilmfestival.org. On February 6th, KBOO and the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee will co-present a screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, about the renowned activist. Show starts at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, and you can learn more at cstpdx.com. From February 10th through the 27th, the Portland Black Film Festival returns to the Hollywood Theater, brought to you for the 4th time by Portland writer, filmmaker, and film historian David Walker. With 7 films showcasing the cinematic achievements of African-American stars and filmmakers and examining the Black experience in America. Lots of rare 35mm prints, documentaries, a hip-hop compilation with rerun theater, and an evening with actor Fred Williamson, who will present a 35mm screening of his film Black Caesar on February 27th at 7 p.m. More details available at hollywoodtheater.org. On February 11th, the ongoing Portland Eco Film Festival hosts a screening of the documentary Suno at the Hollywood Theater at 7:30. It'll be the U.S. premiere of the film, which looks at rural Mexican maize producers, prefaced by a live acoustic performance by musician Edna Vasquez. Details available at portlandecofilmfest.org. Also on February 11th at the Clinton Street Theater, KBOO brings you Contessa de la Luna's 10-year anniversary performance and live show, featuring an old-fashioned variety show just in time for Valentine's Day with longtime fabulous KBOO host Contessa de la Luna. Show kicks off at 7 p.m. with more information at cstpdx.com or at our website, kboo.fm. That about wraps it up. Have a great month, everybody.
Thank you, Jen. And thanks to our guests today, Ian Sundahl, Kelly Kend, Don Jones Redstone, Howard Mitchell, and Ben Pop. Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. The audio for this show, as well as our extended interviews, will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow. And you can keep up with us on Twitter at @KBOOFilmShow. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Thursday, January 28th, 2016. I'm John Shuck. Four holdouts remain at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge that has been under occupation for nearly a month. The Oregonian has reported that, according to Oath Keepers, a Montana man left this morning. One of the last holdouts, Sean Anderson, says he just wants to go home. Ammon Bundy, the leader of the group since arrested, has told the occupiers to stand down. Meanwhile, a network of so-called patriot groups from across the Northwest issued a call Thursday morning for supporters to flood into Burns and tell the FBI to go home. Opposition to Governor Kate Brown's proposal to raise the minimum wage has countered opposition from Linn County. The Linn County Board of Commissioners, in a letter to the legislature and the governor, said that the proposal to raise the wage to as much as $15.52 an hour over the next several years is unconstitutional. The commissioners claim that the state cannot impose mandates without providing funding to implement them. The commissioners had calculated that the minimum wage increase would cost Linn County $2.25 million per year. Alaska Airlines revealed on Wednesday that it will add daily nonstop service between Portland and Atlanta. The service launches June 4th. The Portland to Atlanta red-eye flight will depart, taking off at 11:40 p.m. and arriving in Georgia at 7:30 a.m. A 300-foot yacht owned by Microsoft's billionaire co-founder Paul Allen has allegedly caused extensive damage to a protected area of coral reef in the Cayman Islands. According to officials, the anchor chain on Paul Allen's vessel damaged 80% of the coral reef in Grand Cayman's West Bay replenishment zone. Mr. Allen has denied responsibility.